Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Hello and a pleasant good morning. Once again, this is C.A. Nuri, and today is Wednesday. It's Wednesday, March 27th, and it's a little after 11 o'clock in the morning. Once again, this is C.A. Nuri, and I shall be your host for the day as we have a discussion. Discussion from representatives from the National Insurance Board, right? On July 1st, 2024, they're going to increase our contribution rates. And I want to have a discussion on that, of why. Why they got to increase the rates again? But I find that I had a number of inboxes who seemingly do not understand what exactly is the National Insurance Board, why it was created, why this whole concept has come about. So before I talk about the increase of the rates, before I discuss and have the two guests explain why the rate hike is important, I want to understand what exactly is National Insurance. And I have with me two representatives. I have Mr. Jason Moxey, who is a consultant for public relations and training, and Mr. Tommy Francis, am
Trevor
I right?
Trevor Bryce.
Trevor Bryce? I'm writing down your name. Forgive me, Mr. Bryce. Trevor Bryce. You're also a consultant on part of compliance.
Senior manager compliance.
And talk directly inside the mic, forgive me.
Yeah, I'm senior manager, the compliance department.
Excellent. So we'll start with you, Mr. Moxey. NIB, history of NIB, what is the mandate so I can, my listening audience can appreciate the conversation of why we need this rate hike?
A very pleasant good morning to the Bahamas, and thank you very much, Mr. Nuri, for having us here. Let me start by indicating prior to the introduction of national insurance, our government provided a social assistance program that was administered through the courts and funded out of the consolidated fund. This assistance program provided for those persons who had attained the age of 65, which was paid in the form of old age non-contributory pension. They also paid an assistance to those persons who were rendered permanently incapable of work, and they paid an assistance to the dependents of the breadwinner of the family. This particular program was administered through the courts and funded out of the consolidated fund. In 1974, or shortly after the introduction of the National Insurance Program, the assistance program funded by government was grandfathered into the National Insurance Program in January of 1975, when the amount was increased from $13 per month to $26 per month. That particular aspect of the program was continued to be funded by government until it was determined that those persons who were grandfathered into the National Insurance Program had died. So it was sometime during the early 1970s that the government appointed a tripartite committee consisting of persons representing government, employers, and employed persons. And they were given responsibility to review that program and to recommend to government the best form of social security for the Bahamas, having regards for the social and economic conditions that prevailed at that time. This committee had the assistance of an expert from the International Labor Organization, and they not only produced an interim, but also a final report, which was subsequently approved by the Cabinet of the Bahamas and the Parliament of the Bahamas, and came to be known as the National Insurance Act of 1972. Some months later, 12 sets of regulations were similarly approved by the Parliament that provided the framework for the administration of the National Insurance Program. So it was on the 7th of October, 1974, that National Insurance was introduced in the Commonwealth of the Bahamas. In the first instance, it was to be applied only to employed persons. And some 18 months later, on the 5th of April, 1976, was extended to include self-employed persons. And the main purpose for the National Insurance Program really is to provide income during the contingencies of maternity, sickness, unemployment, funeral, retirement, invalidity, survivor's benefit, and under the industrial branch of the program, which provides coverage in the event a person suffers an accident arising out of and in the course of their employment, injury, disablement, death, funeral, and free medical care.
So you're trying to say that National Insurance Program is not a tax, but a benefit?
Absolutely. In other words, it provides, as I mentioned earlier, to provide income replacement during the various contingencies, those benefits that I made mention of. Now, persons of, and initially the rate of contributions paid by employed persons was 8.8%, shared 3.4% employees portion, and 5.4% employers portion. As it relates to self-employed persons, there were two categories of self-employed persons. One lot paid 8.8% because they were covered under the industrial branch of the program, and the other paid 6.8%, which was not covered under the industrial branch of the program. However, later, all self-employed persons were covered under the industrial branch, so all self-employed persons paid at a rate of 8.8%.
Again, I stop you there again. So everybody who's working should be paying national insurance?
Absolutely. Both domestic workers as well as self-employed persons. That is critical, and as a matter of fact, I'm sure Mr. Bryce will speak to the challenges the board faces as it relates to self-employed persons. But again, you know, there is this confusion as it relates to an increase in the insurable wage compared to that of a rate increase
for
contributions.
I come in there.
And I just want to make it clear, when the program was initially instituted, contributions were paid based on the first $100 that one earned. So the first insurable wage increase occurred in 1984, when the insurable wage moved from $100 or $110 to $250. And there have been multiple insurable wage increases, the last having occurred in 2022, when the insurable wage was increased from $710 to $740.
And I want to pause you there, forgive me. Mm-hmm. What does that mean, increasing insurable wages?
Well, again...
Isn't that the increase there?
No, that's not. All right? Because there's a difference between a rate increase and an insurable wage increase. An insurable wage increase will only affect those persons whose salary is above whatever the existing insurable wage ceiling is. So, again, as I indicated, the law mandate that every 2 years, the board is to review the retail price index to determine the level of salaries that are being paid in the country, because benefits need to be relevant to the salary one earned. Back in the 70s, salaries were extremely low, and so that's why the insurable wage ceiling was only $110. Today, the insurable wage ceiling is $740, and it's likely to increase in July of this year.
I pause you again, forgive me. Mm-hmm. So besides the rate increase, you said it may be likely that the insurable wage, there'll be an increase also in the ceiling.
Precisely, and that would only affect those persons who currently earn above $740. So those persons who earn less than $740, they would not be affected. Now, a rate increase is different. And there's been one rate increase since the inception of NIB.
$740, is that a week or a month?
Per week. $740 per week is the existing insurable wage ceiling. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So you're saying there's only been one rate increase?
One rate increase. And that rate increase occurred in the year 2010. If you will recall, prior to 2010, the Bahamas was there was a recession between 2008, 2009. And so government then decided that they would utilize a portion of NIB fund in order to provide assistance to those persons who were unemployed, resulting in July of 2010, a 1% rate increase was introduced.
Okay.
And at the same time, it was introduced to bring in unemployment benefit, because unemployment benefit was not a part of the benefit package offered by National Insurance.
In 2010, there was a rate increase.
A rate increase.
And that rate increase was to start that unemployment benefit.
Precisely.
Okay,
precisely.
There hasn't been any other rate increase since then.
Since then.
So when they increased the ceiling,
yes.
What that money going for?
All right, well, there's a corresponding increase in the benefits to be paid. Currently, at $740, person who's paying at the ceiling of $740, their sickness benefit is $444 per week. So if, for example, the ceiling goes to $800, then the benefit, there's a corresponding increase in the rate of in the payment of benefit. That person now will get $480.
So wherever the ceiling is increased,
the benefits increase.
I get more benefits.
Precisely. There's a corresponding increase in benefits. Now, a rate increase is because there is a need. Well, in the first instance, it happened because the introduction of unemployment benefit. This rate increase now is because of the expenditure of the board exceed its benefit or its contribution intake.
So
right?
Let me, and I'm not good in math, and that's why I normally bring in Aaron, mm-hmm. right? You're trying to say that NIB, the board, is revenue is less than its expenditure now?
Absolutely. And it's been that way from 2016. As a matter of fact, the board has been running almost $90 million a year.
In a deficit?
From contribution. Hence, the divestment of...
How long has it been going on?
From 2016. And I'll get to why... and we're now talking, we want to talk about the rate increase. I guess your question is, well... why is there a need to increase the rate of contribution? As I mentioned, because of the deficit the board is experiencing as a result of the payment, not only of benefits, but also administrative costs.
What caused the deficit, though?
Because the rate of contribution is insufficient. And I go back then to 1974, when the program was first introduced, right? We were a relatively young population, where there were seven persons in the workforce for every one pensioner. Life expectancy then was 69 for male and 71 for female. Today, life expectancy for the male is 71 and a half years. For female, it's 73 and a half years. Persons are living longer. In addition, today, there are only four persons in the workforce for every one pensioner. The board currently pays in excess of pays pension to in excess of 46,000 persons per month at a cost of in excess of $27 million per month. That does not take into consideration the payment of sickness, maternity, unemployment, funeral, and benefits under the industrial branch of the program, namely injury, disablement, death, funeral, and free medical care. That cost alone for those benefits is in excess of $6 million per month. So long-term benefit being 27, short-term being $6 million, that's $33 million. Revenue from contribution is approximately $28 million per month. And it does not take into consideration the administrative costs.
The shortfall on revenue being brought in, right? Be deficient there.
Yes.
It doesn't match operational costs and benefit payout.
Yes.
In that section right there, has a determination been made, or is any of that loss due to entities not paying contributions?
Well, in part, that is the challenge. That has been the challenge for the board from its inception, the level of compliance. And every effort is being made in order to deal with that. But notwithstanding the level of compliance, mm-hmm. in the absence of an increase, and I will indicate a number. There are a number of recommendations made by the actuary report.
Mm-hmm.
For example, one, they did indicate that the fund or the expenditure exceeded revenue from 2016. They had projected that the board funds would be depleted by the year 2029 if nothing was done. Now it's moved up to 2028. They're also saying that a rate of contribution of approximately 15.65% is necessary at this stage in order for us to meet our obligation by the year 2029, mm-hmm. or an increase of 22.65% to meet our obligation by the year 2078. And so, and the another recommendation was that we move the minimum number of contributions to qualify for retirement benefit from 500 to 750 contributions, which would 500 currently would give you a rate of 30%. They had recommended that we move it from 500 to 750, which is an additional 5 years. They also recommended that we should increase retirement age from 65 to 67, but that would not happen until the year 2030, and it's to happen over a 24-year period of time. So in other words, for each year, you would increase the retirement age by 1 month. Similarly, to move the early retirement from 60 to 62, and likewise, you would increase that over a 24-year period. So there are some of the recommendations, along with the proposed or the suggested 1.5% increase.
Am I going to talk about this 1.5?
But can the labor force tolerate people working for 5 years longer and filling spaces in the labor force? Can it tolerate that? And is there any agency that is sort of assessing that?
Well, yes. I mean, they look at. I mean, the actuarial review really deals with the demographics of the country. Mm-hmm. All right. I mean, for example, many years ago, retirement age in the public service was 60 years of age, mm-hmm. right? And that was across the board. I think government recognized at some point in time that there was a shortage of teachers and nurses, resulting in them amending the law to allow persons to work to the age of 65. They made that optional for all quasi-government corporation. If they wanted to do so, they could have increased their retirement age to 65. I believe the only quasi-corporation that retire one at 65 is that of Bahamas Air. But that was a trade-off for a reduction in salary many years ago, mm-hmm. when they were experiencing some financial difficulties. And government decided that, look, either we reduce your salary or we'd have to lay off some persons, mm-hmm. all right? And then as a result of negotiations, they were able to get a trade-off by extending the retirement age from 60 to 65. But again, it's optional for all quasi-government corporations if they so wish. None of them, to my knowledge, has adopted it.
You used the term depletion of the funds,
yes.
right? And I assume that the NIB Act made the government a guarantor that the monies would never deplete, because government could find the money and put it there if the money finished.
Absolutely. The law specifically says if there is a deficiency in the fund, then government is to provide the monies. So therefore, if there's no rate increase in contributions, and then government has to meet this deficiency, well, where are the monies are coming from? It can only come from the consolidated fund. Where do the money from the consolidated fund come from? From taxes. And so, therefore, they will have to add taxes to its citizenship in order to meet its obligation to NIB.
And before I get Mr. Bryce into the conversation, get ready, Mr. Bryce, I come to you, right? Before I get Mr. Bryce into the conversation, I'm going to talk about investments. Uh-huh. My listening audience said, man, governors use my NIB money to buy all kind of dilapidated buildings and mansions that we don't use. Mm-hmm. That government has built all kind of government, NIB has built all kind of government buildings that they have to maintain, right? Surely, from all these rental units that NIB and all these investment portfolios that NIB owns, we can't be short of money. Are we short of money?
Well, let's look at it this way. The board cannot survive solely on the income from contributions. So therefore, the board needs to invest its funds. And a part of its investment policy is to invest in blue chip investments, so to speak. And government being as it is, NIB has invested in registered stock, treasury bond, and similarly, they've provided financing on a lease purchase arrangement for government buildings. In other words, they provide the funding, government repay NIB its money on a regular basis. So it's not a question of whether and government just taking NIB's money and constructing building. That's a part of the board's investment policy, portfolio. Additionally, additionally, persons speak about the clinics that were constructed. All right? Now, here's the situation with the clinics. When the program was introduced in 1974, you know that there's a differential of 2% between what the employee's portion of the contribution is and the employer's portion. That 2% represent payment made by the employer for the purpose of the industrial benefit, should a person sustain an injury arising out of and in the course of their employment. The intent when the program was introduced in 1974 was to repeal workman's compensation and replace it with the industrial branch of NIB. That did not happen. It only happened in November of 1980. So there was an accumulation of funds in the industrial benefit branch that the government consulted the International Labor Organization as to what should happen with these monies. They indicated that a portion of the funds should be set aside to improve the health infrastructure of the country because it will benefit the workers who, in fact, may suffer an industrial accident, right? And so, therefore, the commencement of clinics in the Family Islands as well as New Providence took place, right? And so, yes, that particular aspect of it, there was no return to NIB as a result of that because they were funds that were collected and not utilized. So this myth about government takes NIB's money and just use it and don't repay it is absolutely not true.
So government's repaying?
Absolutely.
And the books show
will
that?
Reflect that.
When last, I mean, I don't know if that's on your mandate, but when last we get an audit to say, let me go through these books?
NIB is audited every year.
I could go online now and see the audit?
No, but that's not the correct question. When is the last audit that was gazetted?
Now, that's a good question. I'm not in a position to respond to that, but NIB is audited every year,
okay,
without fail.
A quick question before we transition in terms of where can we find extra funds from. as an agricultural advocate, I always lobby for a relationship between Ministry of Agriculture and Ministry of Tourism. Now that we are talking about the development of the creation of a tourism development fund, is there any possibility at all that a percentage of that fund can be used to fund NIB?
That's a good question.
Put it on the table.
Look at you, Aaron.
Oh, yeah, sorry.
I got excited about that question. Go ahead.
No, I'm unable to respond.
But it's
an excellent idea.
Yeah. Mr. Price. Sure.
Right.
Compliance. I've been reading the article. You just look at that. Anyway, looking at
the break.
Yes, I see April. I got excited. I was looking at an article recently and saying that part of the issues that NIB is having is in compliance, people who are independently contracted or work for themselves, and some businesses ain't paying their share. How is it a real problem? And then how is NIB dealing with that?
Okay, so compliance has always been an issue for NIB in terms of collecting contributions, both from the businesses as well as self-employed. And self-employed continues to be a challenge. And so the way NIB operates in terms of dealing with the compliance issue is we have inspectors who are actually mandated by law to serve as the compliance officers for the board. And so where employers fail to make those contribution payments, the inspector conducts audit of the employer's file. Get from them the contribution records, and then where that employer fails to make those payments on behalf of their employees, then that file is advanced for prosecution. So the matter then goes to court.
But do you get locked up for this if you don't comply? Or just get fined?
I mean, I guess there have been some instances where persons have been locked up, but primarily the matter goes before the court, and they're fined. But they also, along with being fined, they also have an obligation to still pay those arrears. So those arrears don't go away just because the court fine is imposed.
What is the process for self-employed people like myself who may or may not owe a small sum of
you
money on the NIB? Like, I mean, maybe just...
A couple of dollars.
Yeah, I don't owe it at a corporate level, but maybe I owe a couple of dollars. What's the process for self-employed people in terms of recollecting fees, indicating, listen, you're in arrears, and you need, what's the timeline?
Okay, so actually... Contribution payments are actually due at the end of every month, by the 15th of the following month, the latest. If you find yourself in a situation where you haven't paid for a while and you need to catch up, then what we would do is have you sit with an inspector. The inspector reviews your look at your book, to determine what your income would be, and then assess what your monthly payment ought to be. And then they will provide you with an assessed amount of your total arrears. And we would prefer that you pay all of those arrears at once. But if that does not happen, then we work with you to create a payment plan that allows you to address those arrears over a particular period.
I just want to say to the general public, they are very, very easy with you. Right? Don't feel this, because I felt this little trepidation, like, oh, I got to talk to these people about money. Professional, polite, understanding. The most important thing is to make contact and see what you owe and what you can do about it.
Yes. Mr. Price, go ahead.
I just wanted to elaborate further as it relates to self-employed persons. You know, for a self-employed person who was previously an employed person, during their first year of self-employment, they had to pay contribution on the insurable wage ceiling they last paid as an employed person. They would maintain their records for the year, for the ensuing year, and then they would determine their net income for that year divided by 52 in order to determine on what insurable wage they would pay in upcoming year.
Okay.
All right. And so a self-employed person is obligated to pay a contribution every week, even though they may not work every week or earn every week. They may have worked for 6 months of the year, so they would get the aggregate of that 6 months and still divide it by 52 in order to arrive at their average weekly insurable wage in order to pay the following year.
And there's someone who explains this to self-employed people?
Absolutely. Yes, yes. Absolutely. So that is important to know. If you were previously employed, you'd pay based on your last salary. That is up to for 1 year. Mm-hmm. But during that year, you had to maintain your records to determine what your net income was divided by 52. Mm-hmm. That will determine what you pay on in the ensuing year. Okay. All right. Now, where a person was not previously an employed person, they have the option of determining on what insurable wage they would pay on for the first year. Mm-hmm. Again, they would maintain their records. They may have decided to pay on $200 since they were not previously an employed person. They may decide to pay on $200. And so therefore, they would pay on the $200 every week. But they might be earning $600 a week, right? But at the end of the year, they would take their aggregate for the year divided by 52, and that would be the insurable wage on which they pay the ensuing year. But bear in mind always that your benefit payment is contingent on the insurable wage that you pay contribution on. So you find a lot of self-employed person, they might pay on a mega amount, and then when it's time to receive a benefit, they say, well, oh, I was making $600, why are you only paying me 30% or 60% of the $200? So that is important to know.
I have two questions, right? What if I'm a taxi driver, right? And I haven't been paying for a while, right? Or I didn't realize I was supposed to pay because I said, it's my money. Right? I'm not giving a look at national insurance benefit, but I have decided 5 years later, I want to pay because when I retire, I want to get something. Do I have to go backwards and pay all those years I didn't pay, or can I start from year 2022, move forward?
You were legally obligated. But go ahead.
You're legally obligated to go back from when you actually started your self-employment. So which means that we would actually take you back to 5 years when you first became self-employed as a taxi driver.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. We had a call who called last week, claimed that he used to work for Bahamas Blenders. I'm familiar. I mean, kind of youngish, but I'm familiar that Bahamas Blenders changed companies. It's a new company, formed a new company, transitioned. He's having issues saying, man, they can't find his Bahamas Blenders NIB records. And I said, no, my Bahamas Blenders is a big company. I know it changed names, right? Who is responsible for finding this money? Because he's saying Bahamas Blenders didn't pay it.
Okay, so in that instance, usually the person probably would have come in and filed a complaint with the compliance department. And so what we would do is have the inspector reach out to the employer to ascertain the information that the person would have provided to say they were working for XYZ period. This was their salary. We'd reach out to say Bahama Blender to verify that information, and then also to get those contribution records for that employee. And bear in mind, even if it's a situation where it has been determined that person would have been employed by that company and their contribution was not deducted at that time, the employer still has the obligation to pay for those contributions. The difference is they can't go back into the employer salary or anything to take it out. They then have 100% responsibility for paying that entire amount that's outstanding.
Okay. You have a question because I'm going to ask for this prescription drug plan and who paying for that? Is that the NIB paying for prescription drug plan or that come from the consolidated fund?
Well, let me ask this question first.
Don't let them get that question.
No, I'm scared. Prescription drugs, but I'm scared. Okay. Is it against the law to not pay NIB?
Absolutely.
Yes. Now, what if I'm a self-employed person?
Yes.
It's against the law to pay a NIB.
All persons employed in the Commonwealth of the Bahamas who are legally employed, right, over the age of 16, is obligated to register and pay national insurance contribution. There are some exemption.
Mm-hmm.
For example, persons who work in, say, the U.S. Embassy, Bahamians who work there, unless the embassy, which they have, what is the word? They've opted to pay national insurance for their employees. If they did not, then the employees who work in the embassy, in fact, would have had to register and pay a self-employed person. So they've waived their right. The embassy, to allow for the Bahamians who work in the embassy that they will be responsible for the payment of their contribution.
Now, what if I have a small home cottage business, right? Like I don't have a business license, but I'm able to generate a certain amount of money per week, per month. Am I required to pay NIB, or is the penalty for not paying no benefit at the end of the day?
You would still be required to pay. because technically you are still gainfully employed, even though you may have a home-based business.
Mm-hmm.
Without brick and mortar, you have a home-based business, so you would still have an obligation to pay NIB contribution.
We can
still legally prosecute you for failure to pay those contributions.
You see, and what is happening now, we have this relationship with the Inland Revenue,
mm-hmm.
where most businesses, you require a business license, you require TCC, and in order for it to be granted or renewed, you must show proof that you're registered, and on renewal, you must show proof that you're current with your national insurance contribution. In the absence of that, you would be denied a business license or your TCC.
What about those foreigners on work permits? Do they pay NIB?
We have that relationship with the Department of Immigration.
Do they get back benefits too?
Absolutely.
What if they leave and go into a different foreign country?
Doesn't make a difference.
Hold on, what I'm saying is they've been gone for 17 years. I could borrow some of their benefit, right?
No, you must be a contributor yourself. And that is why it's so important for self-employed persons in particular, because they're the persons who at the end of their work life come to national insurance looking for some form of assistance, and they expect the contribution you or I would have paid should provide them with some form of assistance. And that is why it's important for self-employed persons in particular, and those domestic employees. You and I who hire maids and gardeners in our home, they too, you should ensure that they are registered and you're paying contributions on their behalf, because they are the persons who are in need of NIB at the time of their retirement, because there's no mandated retirement plan by employers.
And I would say to those small employers, right, talk to your employee. Talk to them about how much of what you're paying them should be set aside for their NIB contribution.
And as a matter of fact, I want to encourage persons to either visit the customer service department of NIB, where they can get a copy of their contribution printout to ensure that their employers are paying, and they're paying at the correct rate. Or alternatively, if they call into the customer service department, they can be given a PIN number in order to access their contribution history online.
So I can go and find out, I'm callers coming in now. I can go online and find out if people are paying, my employees are paying my contributions.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I forget my national prescription drug plan, by the way. Who funding that? That's NIB or is that consolidated fund money?
Consolidated fund money. That's a government funded program. Initially, when it was introduced initially, NIB provided the funds.
They still want money for that, NIB?
I couldn't speak. I
understand. I just want to put on the record. I asked a question.
No.
I want to know.
It's a government funded program.
All right, we have a caller. We have a caller. Number of texts.
Okay. Go ahead, caller. Oh, okay. They hung up. Don't need to put on your.
All right.
Go ahead with the text.
Here's a quick text. If a person owes NIB payments, can they still have their NIB card renewed? But Texter, the process has changed. I think only the new holder of the card and retirees have to come in regularly with their NIB card. But your card, once it's been issued, it remains the same. It doesn't expire.
So if the person owes NIB contribution and their card needs to be renewed
or replaced,
they can still come in and get those cards.
Yeah, that does not affect.
Yeah, that don't affect them.
All right. Okay. And particularly because it's also used as a form of national identity,
precisely.
Right?
Precisely.
Yeah. Absolutely.
We soon go on to the rate hike and have the discussion on the rate hike. But I want to...
Prescription.
We did prescription already.
Okay.
Yeah, answer that.
Okay.
I want to talk about compliance about someone who supposed to get verified. I think that's the right word, right?
Verification is a benefit process.
Benefit, yes.
Which is a pension process where your birth month and 6 months thereafter, you're required to verify that your circumstances have not changed.
Right? What if the person was away and did not get verified for the year or whatever, and they come back and they just verified how, and they... payment, the benefit was lapsed or discontinued?
It would be reinstated retroactive to the date it was discontinued. There's no loss of benefit as a result of your verification. It's just that your benefit would be suspended until such time as you verify. The same thing happens, say, for example, for survivor's benefit, where the continuation of survivor's benefit in respect to children is where the board is satisfied that the child, in particular a child who would have attained the age of 16 and under the age of 21, they must verify every semester that they are still in school. So what happens then for high school students, their benefit is suspended in September or October if they do not provide proof that they are still in school. For college students, their benefit is suspended in May or June until they confirm in September when they're back in school. And it will then be reinstated retroactive to May or June if it was suspended from then.
I see we have a caller now who wants to engage. Producer, patch that caller through for me, please. Go ahead, caller.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi, I'm Tony Williams calling from the National Insurance Board Public Relations Department.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
And I just wanted to help our guest out a bit. The question was asked, as it relates to when last was our audited statement done?
Yes, and put online.
Or gazetted.
Gazetted.
So I just want to say that the last audited financial statement was as of December 31st, 2022. The 2023 statements are currently being audited.
Okay.
We also are required to publish our annual report. The last annual report that was published was just 2019. And of course, we cannot publish those documents until those documents have been tabled.
So from 2019, it hasn't been tabled, and we're still waiting.
That's been tabled, and it can be found on our nib-bahamas.com website.
Yes, because I checked the website for 2019, and that was the last one for 2019. Is there anything subsequent?
Yes, and so right now we currently have two more annual reports that are waiting to be tabled.
Okay.
And also to mention that we also are required by the Act to also conduct the actuarial, and the last one that was conducted was the 11th, and that was as of December 2018. And so we have posted this information on our website and our Facebook pages. It is a requirement by law, And so we want to assure the public that NIB is meeting our mandate and that this information is available, and they're being very transparent about that. So I just wanted to insert that for our representatives who were not equipped to answer the question before, okay?
And I appreciate that. And thanks very much for calling in, Ms. Williams.
Thank you.
Thank you too, Ms. Williams.
Thank you. Good. So let's talk about your increases, right? And the benefits of the increases. I read you're planning to increase 1.5% every 2 years. That's what I read. I didn't say it's true, but I said that's what I read. You want to read that in the record?
Well, no, I just want to read. So what happened is on the 7th of March, on the 6th of March, on the 7th of March, we have the article indicating when Alfred Sayers introduced the increase. The minister at the time indicated the increase would recur every 2 years. That same day, the Office of the Prime Minister released a statement indicating that Mr. Sayers was reading directly from the actuarial review, but at this time, the government had not made a decision on whether they would implement the recurring increase.
So pause right there, Aaron.
Yeah.
I would need to know what's an actuary and what's an actuary review. Go on the record so other people understand who it is that Minister Sayers was reading from. Okay. When you're ready to answer that. Then you go ahead again.
All right. Like I said, so the Prime Minister indicated that at this time they will implement a 1.5% increase in July. They will take the time over the next 2 years to make assessments of the value of that increase.
Precisely.
And before they make a decision that they will continue to increase in 2026, they will make a determination whether the measures taken have been sufficient to put NIB on the right path, whether they can make internal changes to achieve the numbers that they want to achieve, and that perhaps the increase may not be necessary at all, or they may increase at a lower rate in the next 2 years.
Well, that confused me.
Okay,
we're going to take a commercial break.
Okay.
But I want you to explain what an actuary review is, what's the actuary, and why the minister listened to this actuary review, and then the government responds to that, please. Anyway, Guardian Radio at AM with C.A. Nuri. Of course, we have Mr. Trevor Bryce, and of course, we have Mr. Moxie. Where was Mr. Moxie first name? Jason Moxie is with me. They're consultants, and Mr. Bryce is a manager of compliance. But we'll be right back to continue our conversation about the NIB rate increase and what it will be come July 1st, 2024. We'll be right back.
Looking for some fun this Easter weekend? Join us at Nassau Cruise Port for our Easter Sip and Shop on Saturday, March 30th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. Find amazing products from six of your favorite Bahamian brands: Bahari, House of Assembly, Vita Kyle, My Ocean, Bahama Handprints, and Great Cliff. Plus, shop from over 50 authentically Bahamian vendors. Join us for a day of prizes and giveaways with your first drink on us. Don't miss the Easter Sip and Shop at Nassau Cruise Port. The place to be.
Wait, you know what's going down tomorrow?
Nobody, what happening?
Joe bringing the knife to school? He could do Junior in?
For what?
Wait, he fooled with Joe girl?
Mother sick. And you know Junior don't bog down for nothing. So that means he got a big fight tomorrow.
So whose side you on?
Side? I trying to stay in school, not Simpson fan. We gotta tell somebody about this fight.
Tell somebody? I ain't no snitch. I mean, cool, you know.
Wait, if you so cool, then you need to stay in school and stay out of the fight.
Yeah, but if I don't hang on Joe's side, him and he boys coming for me next.
All right, so we definitely gotta tell somebody. We gotta prevent the fight.
What I say, I don't want nobody call me snitch.
We could just call Crime Stoppers. You could report what you know, and nobody gotta know it's you.
So how do I avoid?
All you gotta do is call them, or you text them through the Crack Crime Bahamas app, and nobody can know it's you.
Then the police come looking for me for more info, and when they finish with them, Joe them coming looking for me?
When you call Crime Stoppers, the calls go directly to Miami, and they don't ask nothing about you. Then you can get the pin from them, and they can claim a reward later using that same pin.
Plus, everything's scrambled, so nobody can read what you're saying.
Calls 308-8477 from Nassau, or 242-300-8477 from the Family Islands.
The Grand Bahama News is available available every Tuesday in the Nassau Guardian. You can buy your local paper at Freeport convenience stores, Western Bakery, DeGregory's Fine Foods, and Bellevue Gifts. Now is the time to reach your Grand Bahama market with affordable packages, including print and digital. Call GB News sales representative Kavondre at 822-6717 or message him on WhatsApp for ad rates. Classified ads are now available every Tuesday as well. Keep up with everything Grand Bahamian every Tuesday in the Nassau Guardian.
Love the show? Want to give your support? Become a sponsor today. Call 302-2300 for our rates and packages. That's 302-2300. Become a sponsor on Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
I hope you have a great day.
Good morning and welcome back to Guardian Radio AM with C.A. Newry. We opened the show just now with the song Great Day, Great Day that was produced during the pandemic when many people were not working, didn't know how they were going to make a contribution, didn't know how they were going to survive. And the song was made by a group of young people attempting to cheer us up. And in the video is one and only April Moss from the Guardian family.
April inside the video.
And we say good morning to April and welcome back. We missed you.
Yes.
We're glad you're back. And if you need any help with that NIB contribution, I have a couple cookout this weekend.
Yes.
But I want to speak to what happened during the pandemic. Yes. Okay. On average, the board paid anywhere between 6,000 to 7,000 persons per year unemployment benefit. During the pandemic, that number increased to in excess of 44,000 persons who were paid unemployment benefit at a cost of $107 million. Can you imagine what would have happened during the pandemic to those persons had it not been for national insurance?
Mm-hmm.
A tremendous help to those persons. Can you also imagine those persons whose employer do not have a pension plan for them, right? On retirement, who do they turn to for assistance? Today, they are able, through NIB, to receive a pension. It's not, in some instances, it's not relative to the salaries that, you know, C.A. Newry makes, maybe $50,000, $60,000, because he's not paying on that total amount. He's only paying on the first $740. But the maximum pension payable today to a person who would have contributed to national insurance for a period of 40 years. And it will vary depending on your years. But the maximum pension today is about $1,826 per month that a person can receive from national insurance after 40 years of contribution to NIB. And so, you know, in my humble opinion, the National Insurance Program is the best piece of social legislation ever introduced in the Commonwealth.
Listen, when I retire at 87, Mr. Newry, when I retire at 87, mm-hmm. and I get all that money, I get the $1,800 a month, I'm going to ball you up. I can take you on a cruise, but give me 40 years. I just need to work on that.
I'm just hoping to live that long.
If you're a contributor, and yes. you pay it on the maximum insurable wage.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about what can I expect on July 1st, 2024. Your plan to increase my benefits, right?
No, the rate.
I ain't getting no benefits?
No.
Just the rate?
Just the rate. There would be a rate
before
increase.
You start that, mm-hmm. what are my benefits now before this rate increase? And then talk about the rate increase.
Well, again, you know, the benefits available under the program is that of sickness, maternity, unemployment, funeral, retirement, invalidity, survivors. They are the general benefits branch, which requires certain contribution conditions. And under the industrial branch, a person can take up employment today and is injured on the job today. That person is covered for injury benefit, which can result in the payment of disablement. If they die as a result of that injury, they can get their dependents can get death benefit. There's a funeral benefit payment, as well as they receive free medical care. So without having paid any contributions to NIB, they are covered under the industrial branch of NIB.
That includes self-employed people?
Self-employed persons as well. They are covered. You know, remember I said earlier, when the program was first introduced, only a certain category of self-employed persons paid 8.8%. Mm-hmm. The others paid 6.8%, which means those who paid 6.8% was not covered under the industrial branch. And since then, the board has included all self-employed persons, provide them coverage under the industrial branch of NIB. There was another, one other portion of your question you'd ask that I...
Well, I want to know, what can I anticipate come July 1st?
Okay, so again, the rate of contribution is expected to increase by 1.5%. That 1.5% would be shared equally between the employee and the employer. Currently, an employed person pays 3.9%, so their contribution now will go to 4.65%. An employer's contribution, which was 5.9%, will now go to 7.65%. Excuse me. Mm-hmm. For example, an employer who has a monthly payroll, say of $50,000 per month, mm-hmm. the additional cost to that employer would be $375 per month or $4,500 for the year. Mm. That's all the increase. And I think it's worth that amount to ensure that your employees have some form of income based on the various contingencies that they are faced with. A $50,000 a month payroll will only cost you an additional $375 per month. In other words, it will go up 0.75% of $50,000 is $375 for the month or $4,500 for the year.
I see I have another caller who wants to engage. Just put on your headphones there. But I see you call the employers. I'm an employee. I haven't reached that employer status yet, right? Mm-hmm. So I always want to know how it impacts me in my pocket.
Okay.
Right? But no, let me go to the caller for a minute and then you can respond. Go ahead, caller. Can you hear me?
Good morning. It's almost afternoon, but I would like to find out some information. And you can look into it for me, please, with National Assurance. If your husband died, is the wife entitled to survivor's benefit? And if she is not already elderly, don't she is entitled to have a pension also? I would like to know that, please. And the next question is, the commercial what they have on the radio stating that people are living longer. I think they need to discontinue that. That is not fair to the elderly people.
You don't think it's fair to the elderly people?
Did they live longer?
Yes, if they're living longer, let them live.
Well, I mean, we can stop them from letting them live.
It don't sound
right, because if you leave it up to me, I can have them working side by side with my Chikchanis.
Yes, but it would be good, but... The commercial don't sound good like that because they already contribute.
They listen.
But the point about it, don't have it that they're living longer. See, it makes you feel like you're looking for them to die.
I feel you.
Listening. Go ahead.
Okay, as it relates to the payment of survivor's benefit, where did the deceased... The
1 minute left.
Okay. Where the deceased person, in fact, would have made a minimum of 150 paid contribution and leave a surviving spouse who is either an invalid or over the age of 40 and incapable of work, or who is pregnant by her late husband, or has a child under the age of 16 or 21 and still in school, she will qualify for survivor's benefit. On her attaining the age of 65 and she applies for retirement benefit, it means that her benefit that she was receiving as a survivor or the widow will be reduced by 50%. So she will then get both retirement as well as 50% of what the deceased person would have been entitled to for survivor's benefit.
Absolutely.
I appreciate you gentlemen coming on. It was very informative. Go ahead, Aaron. I want to sum up.
No, no,
wait. 30 seconds. Anyway, this has been Guardian Radio with AM. It's now 12 o'clock. Thank you very much, Mr. Bryce. Thank you very much, Mr. Moxie. We need to invite you back on again.
Right. Because NIB won't accept sea grapes as a contribution.
Yes. Anyway, we got to go.
That's my wealth. We have a-